This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
This is Scott Baradell, author of Trust Signals, Brand Building in a Post-Truth World, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Scott Baradell to talk about his book, Trust Signals, Brand Building in a Post-Truth World, published by Lioncrest. Scott Baradell is a writer and entrepreneur who grew his PR agency, Idea Grove, with business generated by its popular blog. Idea Grove is one of the top 25 tech PR agencies in the United States, a three-time Inc. 5000 company, and an Inc. Best Workplace in 2021 and 2022. In 2020, Scott started a second blog, Trust Signals, to provide news, analysis, and practical advice on what it takes to build trust with customers and the public in today's post-truth world. The blog inspired and culminates in this book. Before Idea Grove, Scott was the chief communications officer for $2 billion companies, the co-founder and CMO of a venture-backed startup, and an award-winning journalist. And, interesting fact, during a visit to Japan, his tour bus was attacked by snow monkeys, but somehow he made it out alive. Scott, congratulations on Trust Signals, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, snow monkeys, what happened? Was it just your animal magnetism?
Yeah, good one. I don't know if it was attacked or encountered, to be honest, but I was certainly surprised by the volume of snow monkeys that suddenly appeared around our tour bus. I went there for a business trip, and we got to spend a day, checking out the areas going up in the mountains and stuff, and the snow monkeys came out in force.
Wow. I'm glad you made it through, to if nothing else, to be on the Marketing Book Podcast. So when I was reading the book, which again is called Trust Signals, I could not stop thinking about the movie Meet the Parents with Robert De Niro and Ben Stiller, where Robert De Niro, who plays this ex-CIA agent, often talks about the circle of trust. And Ben Stiller is his future son-in-law. I'm going to play a segment from the movie here where Robert De Niro and Ben Stiller are together at the tuxedo rental place, and he suspects Ben Stiller of some wrongdoing, which Ben didn't do.
Did I not clearly explain the circle of trust to you, Greg?
Mm, yeah, I think I got it.
Then is there something you want to tell me?
I don't think so.
Didn't we have a discussion yesterday in the car about this?
Oh, yes. You mean me and Pam. Yes, I would love to talk to you about
that. We're not talking about Pam, Greg. We're talking about you. See, if I can't trust you, Greg, then I have no choice but to put you right back outside the circle. And once you're out, you're out. There's no coming back.
Well, I would definitely like to stay inside the circle. Yeah.
Well, then tell me the truth.
Okay. Jack, I don't know what we're talking about.
All right, now look, Father, I'm a patient man. That's what 19 months in a Vietnamese prison camp will do to you. But I will be watching you, studying your every move. And if I find that you are trying to corrupt my firstborn child, I will bring you down, baby. I will bring you down to Chinatown.
So when we spoke earlier this week, you were saying that you almost had a different title for the book.
I actually was originally looking at calling it Trust Circles, and because of the idea of circle trust, and I had, I maybe saw one of the Meet the Parents movies. I didn't, you know, it wasn't one of my favorites or anything. But I, after having probably a half dozen different people reference this from the movies, I was like, I can't. That's all. When I say circle of trust or trust, that's all anybody thinks about. So I can't call it that. But I think Trust Signals ended up being a more fitting title anyway. But yeah.
Yes. Well, and you talk in the book about signals like lighthouses going back in history. And you just don't want Robert De Niro chasing you down. If you've ever watched Taxi Driver, that's just not, it'll probably affect your sleep. So, but, you know, joking aside, it is somewhat applicable to businesses to always be thinking about Robert De Niro's circle of trust. And Marcus Sheridan, who's the author of They Ask You Answer, he always talks about how we're all in the trust business. We just might happen to be providing roofs or tech products or medical devices, but we're really in the trust business. And that's why I liked your book so much. And I want to mention that the book is really terrific, and it's extremely well written, which is not surprising because I've never had a book on the show by a former journalist that's not extremely well done. And the introduction is really good. And to you listeners, if you go on Amazon and find this book, you can read the introduction and the first chapter for free in the preview. Sorry, Scott, but I just I want people to know that, you know, before you buy it, you can at least read this first section, which I really liked. And I want to quote from two parts of the book, page 10 and page 204. On page 10, you write, "Trust Signals is all about the tools and tactics that businesses can use to build, grow, and protect their brands. And while marketers and business owners can deploy the practices outlined in this book, my belief is that this work is uniquely suited to PR practitioners who have always focused on earning credibility rather than selling products. PR firms and corporate communications departments don't need to be all things to all people. They must simply become better than any other type of agency or function at understanding what makes buyers and other audiences trust. If PR leaders truly want to elevate their profession, if they want to guide corporate identity, lead brand strategy, and report to the CEO again, that's the path for doing it. This book will show you how." And then on page 204, you write, "We live our lives online today. Hence, how we appear in a Google search is more important than a mention in a newspaper article. That's why PR today must take a broader approach to building and maintaining reputation, one encompassing all the ways audiences gain or lose trust in brands." So, Scott Baradell, first question, what is the dirty little secret about PR?
The dirty little secret about PR is that it's media relations to most of our clients, despite the fact that PR people will swear up and down that it's more than that. They just can't describe what more than that means. And so it reverts back to, hey, can you get me media coverage? They go back to Tony Curtis and Sweet Smell of Success and chasing around Burt Lancaster, sleazy columnist, to try to get coverage for his clients. That's, you know, basically what people think about when they think about PR today is how they thought about it when it emerged 100 years ago. It emerged as a profession 100 years ago as a junior partner, basically to the media. You had a guy named Ivy Lee who had been a journalist. He saw that this was the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century where the abuses of the big railroads and oil companies and stuff were starting to get the government's attention. That's where antitrust legislation and Teddy Roosevelt's progressivism, all this was coming about. And companies started to worry about, for the first time really, what the average people thought about them. And so railroads, for example, would have big crashes, fatal crashes. Not only would they not, say, put out a press release or talk to the journalists about it, they would deny they happened. They would just deny the crash happened. And that's the level of disrespect or disregard big companies back then had for the public. And so, but what was happening is they were about to, you know, chickens were coming home to roost. Companies were going to get broken up. They realized, you know, we have to pay more attention to the public's, you know, opinion of us now. So Ivy Lee, a former journalist, came about and said, hey, why don't we actually do something like tell them the truth? You know, next time there's a fatal crash, it was Pennsylvania Railroad, he brought reporters to the scene of the accident and had executives there to talk about it. And what a concept. It doesn't sound groundbreaking now, but it certainly was then. He put out a declaration of principles and said, first thing it says was, and this was an announcement to the media, I am not an advertising agency. I'm here to share the news with you. And from that moment, that kind of guided the course for what PR became. But really, the reason that Ivy Lee went through the media was that there was a handful of media that people, the public, turned to for truth, or what was considered truth about things. And in an environment today where there are literally thousands of different sources of truth for different audiences, you can't simply just say, hey, you know, I've got a contact at this big publication or that big publication. I'm doing my job as a PR person. No, you're not. You're not. Those publications don't have the same influence tomorrow as they used to, as they had 100 years ago, or even 10 or 20 years ago. So you have to look bigger picture, beyond the tactic of media relations, to achieve what Ivy Lee's goal was 100 years ago, which is to build trust between his client and the public. You have to use different tactics towards that same goal. But too many, the dirty little secret is that too many PR firms still don't do it or know how to do it.
Yes, you're right. PR practitioners have diminished their own profession, mostly by sense of omission. And then you write that the question that really troubles me and that should be of concern to everyone in the public relations business is this. When you start extending the definition of PR beyond media relations, what is truly unique to PR? And I guess if PR clients simply wanted visibility, if they just wanted to raise brand awareness, it would be more cost effective for them to buy ads to follow their target audiences around wherever they went, wouldn't it?
Yes. So the idea is, of course, in this day and age, in the digital world, I can identify my audience and I can retarget the heck out of them. And if I just want you to become aware of my brand, I can make sure you're aware of it. You would hate me because I'd just be annoying you.
Well, if you do bad advertising, yeah.
Well, or frankly, any kind of, you know, what's bad advertising? It has nothing to do with the quality of it. It has to do with whether it's wanted or not.
Right.
And yes. And so if I want to see it, then it's good. The audience decides. Mm-hmm. But if it's not something that you've asked for or that you want to see, it's just going to be annoying. So what the point I make in the book is that there, while clients think of PR as a way of getting brand awareness, there are more cost-effective ways to do that. What you're really trying to do is achieve brand trust. In other words, the reason why you want a media coverage in the Washington Post rather than buy an ad in the Washington Post is because the editorial coverage confers trust on your brand in a way that buying an ad doesn't. And so ultimately, when people come to PR firms, they say they want media coverage. But what they really want is they want that third-party validation to say, this is a company that you can trust. This is a company that is credible, has done important things, other things that say they're worth doing business with. That's really what you look to a PR firm for. So if that's what you're doing, what about other forms of third-party validation, like, you know, getting and maintaining a good presence on review sites online or social media influencers or what have you. I think what happens in PR, so much of the concern has been around, you know, this is what we're not, that you kind of get tunnel vision around doing this one thing, as opposed to, you know, Edward Bernays, who was one of the other early founders of PR, who was, I guess, ultimately his path was not followed like Ivy Lee's was, you know, that PR should really be about understanding what makes the audiences you're trying to reach tick, and then, you know, reaching them where they are. And so this book talks about how if you understand your audiences, then you can understand what sources of information are going to serve to confer that trust, whether it's a particular review site or whether it's, hey, they trust, this audience is more likely to trust Fox News than CNN, whatever it might be, that's the approach you have to take to expand PR beyond kind of this traditional definition that's limited it.
Yes, and I can remember a few years back, a friend of mine had a buddy who had worked at PR for a school, I think it was, and we went to lunch because he'd just gotten laid off, the PR guy. And I remember him saying, you know, I've got all kinds of media connections. I got all the media connections. And I just remember thinking, dude, is that all you have? Plus, you know, the changing nature of the media, how much media is left? And in your book, you actually outline some of the numbers, which are really, I've seen before, but which are very startling. But one of the best lines in the book, which you introduce on page 9, you have throughout. And listener, if you don't remember anything else from this interview, it is this. PR is the art of securing trust at scale.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
I'll say it again. PR is the art of securing trust at scale. Let's go to the breakfast meeting you had with your former colleague, David. This was a really good story. Tell us about that from chapter 1.
Yeah, so the story of David is just, it's someone that I had worked with previously at a previous corporate stop and had helped to promote David as a thought leader. This was at a technology company. He did a great job of explaining complex technologies in ways that reporters could understand.
He was an engineer?
An engineer, but one of those technical people who knew how to speak in plain language. Oh. When you find those as a PR person, that's gold.
Yes.
And so we actually became close friends, and just because he was my go-to, because he did such a good job of connecting on sometimes, you know, any kind of highly technical question, he could relate it or give an analogy or a metaphor or something that made a non-technical person get it. And so, and that's really kind of my agency, Idea Grove. That's a lot of what we try to do. We try to do exactly that, because it's such an important function to serve for technology companies, particularly when they've got engineers and folks like that who maybe aren't as adept at that as leaders. So in the case of David, you know, he had, we had gotten a lot of coverage. I remember there was got in Fortune magazine one time, and it was really based on a vision he had laid out about the future of the industry, as opposed to anything the company we were working for was actually doing at that time. It's just as a vision was so compelling that it drove the story and made the company look like a visionary company. So those are the kinds of things that could really move the needle for companies and help them grow, help them be perceived as industry leaders. And so the story in the book is it's,
He became a CEO, I think.
Right. It's years later. He's become a CEO of a startup, and they had hired a PR firm. It was not a successful engagement because they got some coverage, they share a voice, different metrics seem to move up, but in terms of actually it meaning anything in terms of growing the business, they couldn't make a connection, and so. He said, you know, we did all these things before. In fact, one of the reasons that I was hired was kind of the visibility that I'd gotten before. So let's just do that again. And
let me interrupt. He said, yeah. I want media coverage that will help our salespeople get a better response rate. That really jumped off the page at me.
Right. Well, Yeah, and because they, not necessarily that PR is for sales, it's just that it's great fodder if someone has already seen you in an article, or sometimes the salespeople, you know, might send the article in an email or something. These are things that can just establish that reputation either before salesperson contact is ever made or early on, so the salesperson doesn't have to do all the heavy lifting of establishing trust for the brand. Some of it has been done for them and makes their job a lot easier. So yes, looking for that. And I just said, well, it just doesn't work that any way anymore because, you know, there's just no publications that have that same level of influence as you used to have, I'd say even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. You have to have a more diverse strategy that considers what I call, there's been a lot of talk about inbound marketing and inbound marketing funnels. I like to use the term breadcrumb trail. Mm-hmm. That how it really works today. Because when you talk about inbound funnels, it's often like, we put out this, wrote this thought leadership piece on our blog, and it led somebody to then subscribe to our newsletter, and then we sent them a demo, and then it's like you own this whole funnel experience with people for inbound marketing purposes. It doesn't work that way at all today. It's almost all third party. It's I saw an article in a publication where you were mentioned. I saw an influencer I trust mentioned you. I looked up your reviews online and the reviews were all good. I saw that this certifying organization said you were one of the best at blank. And then finally I landed on your site and saw that you had some good testimonials and so forth. So it's almost all third-party validation that gets them there to you. And the point that I make in the book, and I use the analogy specifically of the path, the breadcrumb path that one of our own team members had gone in finding a crib mattress for their first baby. And one of the breadcrumbs on the path to identifying the mattress she purchased was that they had been mentioned in Parents Magazine. And so the point I make to PR people who take a traditional perspective is, you know, would she have ever bought that crib mattress if all you had done for her is get the mention in Parents Magazine? Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. There are a half dozen different steps. They're connected by the fact that they all happened online, but only one of them was related to the traditional PR approach that David brings up in the breakfast meeting. And so my point to David is, yes, let's do that, but we can't only do that, or it just won't be successful.
Right.
It's a more complex landscape, not as simple as it used to be.
TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flip the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. Well, let's step back. The book's subtitle is Brand Building in a Post-Truth World. Explain what you mean by post-truth world.
Yeah, what I mean for purposes of the book, there's different definitions. The original definition was a guy named Steve Tesich wrote an article, I believe in The Nation, about during the first Gulf War, early 90s, where he basically said he was referring to the fact that that the administration at the time put in place a very strict a pool reporting system that restricted reporters' access to the battlefield and to just information about the first Gulf War in a way that hadn't been the case in previous wars, Vietnam in particular. But if we look back to the traumas of Vietnam, you know, there was such bad news coming from the front, right? You know, so you had journalists running all over the place in Saigon and everywhere, sending back these horror stories and things that American soldiers had done, and just all kinds of things that the public just did not want to see. And of course, it contributed to the war ending, and it didn't end well. It was, the whole experience was bad, right? And so journalists would say it turned into kind of a blame the messenger situation. So you get to the first Gulf War, and well, you're not going to have any of that, whether it happened or not, because journalists didn't have access to be able to report on it in the same way. And what Steve Tesich was kind of lamenting in using the term post-truth world was the public liked it that way. That's what he was seeing. It was like the public didn't want to see the bad news. And they were, you know, kind of freely consenting to be in some post-truth world where what was really happening didn't matter as much as the fact that they could just live their lives without being put in a state of discomfort. And so how that's applied in the case of this book is not in any particular political context or anything like that. It's more to say that we all have the ability today to surround ourselves and be immersed in the information we want to see, and we don't have to see the information we don't want to see. And that's just how social media feeds work. That's how everything works online today. Everything YouTube recommends is what based on what you last saw. They're not going to recommend something that they think you won't like because it has a different point of view from what you last saw. And so that, in a post-truth world, we have to realize in PR or in marketing that that's what you're dealing with. So you can't assume, I'll give you just a practical example. This is when I first started, you know, getting my head around this about 10 years ago, is I had a client in the oil and gas industry, and they, which is generally a very conservative industry. Most of the leaders that I know, I've worked a fair amount in it. They're generally conservative politically and so forth. Well, I had an opportunity that I had secured for the CEO of a company in this space that really did analytics. It was just analyzing efficiency. It was more technical what they did. And secured an opportunity with the New York Times. That's a huge win. In my whole career in journalism, PR, you know, that's all the news that's fit to print. There's not a bigger hit you can get as a PR person, or frankly, as a journalist looking for a job or whatever, than the New York Times. Mm-hmm. But, and he agreed to do the interview. And it was a big one. Actually, the reporter was flying in to do this in person. That doesn't happen a lot. So right before, literally a few days before it was supposed to happen, he calls me and says, I have to cancel this. We're not going to do it. And I said, well,
I couldn't believe this story in the book. Yeah.
I was like, that's going to make someone really unhappy. Are we sure? I vetted this. Look, this is something that is not going to hurt you. It's not, you don't have to worry about it being a gotcha interview or any of those things people worry about. He said, well, you know, I know the New York Times perspective on the oil industry. What's most important is, you know, I've talked to customers because they work with the big oil companies. I talk to customers. I talk to the executives here. And, you know, basically they talked him out of it. They said, we don't care what's in the New York Times. We don't trust the New York Times. Why would you want to be in there anyway? So basically his point of view was that the people that matter to me as a business, as a CEO, don't care about or trust New York Times. Why do I even want to bother with it? And I thought, wow, something's changing, you know.
Yes.
Something's changing. And that's only become, that was 10 years ago. It's only become more that way today. I had a client during COVID who had a really interesting technology solution. I don't want to get too detailed in this particulars, but it was a technology solution that would help some of the issues that arose for businesses during COVID. And I thought, this is really interesting. It was very visual. I thought it's something that could be on TV news and stuff. He says, oh, I don't want to be on CNN or whatever. I only want to be on Fox News because the rest of it's all trash. It would just make me look bad.
Really?
You know, yeah. And yeah, to another group of people, it would be the opposite, right? So the point that I would make and that I made to, in that case, and that I would make in all cases, and it happens on both all sides politically, not just one side or the other, mm-hmm. Is it's not what you think, it's what your audience thinks.
Yes.
So now that's where we get into a concept in the book. It goes beyond, you know, you and I are both fans of Adele Rivella and her approach to buyer personas. We use that same approach in marketing with our clients today in doing buyer persona work for our clients. Well, there's this other dimension, and I call it the trust profile, which is really digging into what are the sources of information that are important to your audience. Which ones do they believe and disbelieve, frankly? Mm-hmm. Which ones do they trust and not trust? And also their values. What are the values that your audiences you're trying to reach share? Because many people are making buying decisions today not based on what's the best product, based on features and benefits, but based on what brand aligns with their values more. You know, so to where the research comes in here and why I think that's so important in terms of this idea of a post-truth world, let's look at someone like Colin Kaepernick. Colin Kaepernick, obviously a controversial figure.
He was an American football player.
Yes. American football player who a few years ago was the first to, he decided as a form of protest against police brutality against African Americans and other issues, decided to kneel during the national anthem at a pro football game. And other players, this kind of caught on a little bit. It's something that the president, President Trump, was very opposed to. So it became a big political issue. And traditionally, that's the kind of thing that brands might have stayed away from.
Mm-hmm.
But Nike decided to make him the face of a big campaign and an anniversary campaign for them. And obviously, to choose that person who represented one idea of truth, mm-hmm. one perspective on where civil rights were in America, any number of things that are associated or would be attached to Colin Kaepernick as a symbol of certain set of values, they had to make a decision. They had worked with him in the past. Do we double down on him or do we cut him loose? They chose to double down on him. They clearly chose to do that based on research. This is a $1 billion decision that's not made by a company like Nike lightly. And so while there were, right after the campaign began, those on the other side of the political fence who were burning their Nikes on Twitter and things like that, ultimately, Nike was able to show tremendous profits that directly impacted stock price from this campaign. It was a huge success. It was a huge success because they knew, based on their research, that in terms of their core client base, this would be a positive rather than a negative. And so what I would say is, hey, yeah, maybe your brand, your customers and audiences are such that they share the CEO's values, or maybe they don't. And so you shouldn't just extrapolate whatever the CEO thinks and thinks that's what your brand's value should be. If you really want to connect your brand to your customers and other audiences and make them trust you, find out what they think. Ask them.
Yes.
Do the same kind of research on trust to build profiles of what your audiences trust as a buyer research would do in finding out what aspects of a product make someone choose you or choose your competitor. Yeah. Same thing. It's just a broader landscape that most companies still don't consider. Certainly mm-hmm. most mid-sized companies. You know, the big companies that spend a ton on market research, and they are factoring these things in now. But I would say the great majority of companies in this country that are not billion-dollar companies, they're not. They're not doing that.
Yes, let me put a pen in this post-truth conversation and quote from page 41 where you write, "Post-truth is simply an acknowledgement that there has been a breakdown in shared sources of truth, such as the mainstream media, government, and big tech, as well as the concept of objective truth." And then you write, "Post-truth doesn't equate to post-trust. It doesn't mean there is less trust or less of a need for trust than in the past." And then on the next page, you write, "The post-truth era has changed who we trust, how we trust, and what makes us trust." You write that we often don't think about it, but we spend our whole lives disseminating and processing trust signals. Explain that.
Well, what I found most compelling about it when I found it, this topic of trust signals, is the more I wrote about it on the blog, the Trust Signals blog, which is at trustsignals.com if you want to check it out. It's very active today.
Yeah, and we'll include a link to it on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com.
But I've been working on that for, you know, over 2 years now. And, you know, as I started thinking about the concept, I just realized while it was a very specific concept, it was very broad in application. So in the same way that you could think about trust signals as a Better Business Bureau seal on an e-commerce site to encourage you to go ahead and give your credit card information, we all use trust signals every day in everything we do. So for example, if I'm a job seeker, I'm going to check out your glass door as an employer to in having 5 stars on Glassdoor is a trust signal to me that you would be a good employer to work for.
Or like your firm, best places to work.
Yes. Yes. On the other side of the equation, you know, I'm also as a job seeker putting all my credentials and things in my resume to make you think you can trust your decision to hire me. The trust signals, if I go out on a date, you know, maybe I'm married with 5 kids, so I'm not doing that. But if I were single and going out on a date these days, I'm sure I would do a little background checking mm-hmm. to vet you. Those are trust signals to make sure, hey, I'm going to be safe on this date, or I'm going to enjoy this date, or this person is worth meeting. This is the kind of thing that all of us do every day without really labeling it or thinking about it. And so it's really applying that idea to business and then trying to get specific about when you're doing business online, what are the things that people look for to decide whether they trust your business or not.
Back to Robert De Niro and Meet the Parents. I was so inspired by that character and how he intimidated his daughter's suitor that that's probably why my daughter is still unmarried, is because she thinks that I just can't resist. Yeah, she never brought any of her dates over here. Yeah, I can understand that. Poor child. Well, let's jump to the section on websites. I mean, there's so many great observations you make in the book, and I want to quote from page 58. You write, "Few things are more important to a brand's reputation than its website. And yet too many companies, particularly as they get caught up in day-to-day running of a business, forget just how central their site is to trust in their organization. Fairly or unfairly, visitors to your home on the web, and in particular, potential customers, make conscious and unconscious judgments about your company based on their online experience." So what are some of these judgments people are making about companies that they may be forgetting about based on their websites? And how are companies blowing it, for lack of a better word, as it relates to building trust using their website?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that, you know, I've thought a lot over the years. Websites are about 25% of what we do, is in talking to clients to get them to just invest a reasonable amount to really put their best foot forward on their website. And so what I found is effective is for particularly with those, say, mid-sized businesses, those entrepreneur-owned businesses that are so focused on, I just put a basic website up. I just want to get out there and sell. It's like, you realize that everything you do on your website is a proxy for other aspects of your business. We are all making shortcut decisions today on everything. A picture's worth a thousand words. It's everything we do. It's like the Malcolm Gladwell book, Blink, you know? So as examples, if your website loads slowly, in terms of a proxy, that's a proxy for having poor customer service. You know, if I see your website loading slowly, I'm going to make consciously or unconsciously the assumption that maybe you do other things slowly. Maybe I'll be waiting on the helpline for too long. If your navigation is confusing, if I can't find what I want easily, I'm going to figure maybe you don't understand me. You know, maybe if I bought your product, I wouldn't be able to understand the user manual or the instructions. You know, if you don't understand how I want to get from point A to point B on your website, how do you know anything about me? It sounds like it would be setting me up for a bad experience. Mm-hmm. If you're not updating your blog, if you're not updating your content, if the copyright says copyright 2012 at the bottom of your site, you know, if it's like that, then I'm probably thinking you're just behind the innovation curve.
Yes.
You know, if you haven't updated your thought leadership content or stuff in your blog, how do I know you're even keeping up with the trends or what's going on? Aren't those things important to make sure that your product is enriched with the latest developments? If you have spelling and grammatical mistakes on your website, I just think you have shoddy workmanship. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a misspelled word on a headline on your homepage, if you're an accountant, do I think you're going to do a meticulous job on my tax return? Or do I think a plumber's going to do a great job on the kitchen sink if they don't bother to check the spelling on their website? These are basic things that I'm just encouraging businesses to take more seriously. Finally, SEO. You know, there. I had a client that I talked to recently. They wanted this beautiful website, and they weren't concerned about SEO. I tried to explain all the reasons why it's important, but ultimately, you can have the most beautiful website in the world, but it's going to be like, you know, having your client meeting in a fancy restaurant, but sitting in the booth by the bathroom, you know, or having your fancy office in a bad neighborhood. It's very important contextually to how seriously you are taken, how Google views you, and how Google views you is based on the presence they give you online. Google is the ultimate arbiter of trust online. There's nobody comes close. Mm-hmm. And so those are all things that too many businesses don't take seriously enough. And that's why I just try to say, if you look at this in terms of a metaphor or analogy, you would take it more seriously and you should take it more seriously.
People are looking for previews. They're looking for signals as to whether they're going to have a terrible experience with you. Let's jump to the Google SEO part. You said Google's the world's ultimate arbiter of trust. And you even quoted one of the co-founders as saying that his company couldn't survive if people didn't trust them. What are some of the basics of getting Google to trust your website?
What's really, interesting, Google is all about trust and their guidelines and stuff. They mention trust over and over again in all the guidance they give to SEOs and stuff. But if you go back to the founding of Google, they were in academia, I guess they were at Stanford, and they saw that in the academic world, the number one trust signal was citations. And if a professor's work was cited in a journal, then that meant that professor's work was taken more seriously, had more credibility. You get enough citations of your work in other people's work, in your peers' work, you're getting promoted, you're getting tenure, you're getting all these things. And they thought, what if we apply this exact same system to websites? And that's where Google came from, is let's apply this system of trust signals academic citations, and a proxy for that would be if other websites link to your website. So that's basically the founding principle of Google. Your website is more trusted by Google if other sites link to your website. Now, of course, once people started to figure that out and the SEO industry emerged, gaming of that started right away, you know, and so Google was always kind of trying to stay one step ahead. But basically, how you get Google to trust you is you have a website that is built the right way from Google's standpoint, and that includes things like your page speed, other things. They're looking at Google Analytics now and determining your ranking too.
So, but just a few things. It's like building a house to code. There's just a couple of things you got to do. It's not that hard. Yeah.
It's very doable. So you just build a good, solid website. That's step one. And the biggest thing your website has to do, besides just being solid, is make it clear to Google what you're about, what your site's about, what your site is good at offering information about. And if you do that, and you can have every page of your site be about something a little different, so you can spread out the things that you rank for example. But once you've done that, then the other part is getting other relevant sites, and that Google's more and more focused on the ones that are more credible, linking to your site. So that's why I point out a huge opportunity for PR that they're starting to get their head around is that, you know, John Mueller, the big search guru at Google, who is the interface with webmasters and SEO folks, he said that one high quality link in a tier one outlet, say a New York Times article that links to your website, could be worth a million low quality links. Mm-hmm. In other words, it could be worth 3 or 4 years of work that your SEO firm has been doing. And that's why, you know, it's so important to think about the quality of links and kind of have an integrated approach to how you approach PR and SEO. So you're not just thinking about one or the other. It's hard enough to get a mention in a quality media outlet. Make sure you're taking advantage of the SEO piece as well.
Yes. Let's jump to another topic here. Lead generation versus trust generation. I want to quote from page 115. I try to pull out all the controversial stuff, Scott. You're right. Yeah. Brand building is not lead generation. It's trust generation. It makes your leads better and your funnel stronger. It can help you avoid commoditization and demand a higher price. It can make the difference in attracting and retaining top talent as well. I've worked with many CMOs whose narrow focus on MQLs and SQLs, which stands for marketing and sales qualified leads, respectively, has mostly led to, and this was new to me, Scott, LQLs, low quality leads.
I came up with that one.
Oh, good. Well done, good sir. You're right. Those are the leads that are often a source of friction and finger pointing between marketing and sales. And then you write, while businesses may look at any number of reasons for leads being of low quality, especially from sources like email campaigns and trade shows, the biggest reason is that companies haven't built sufficient brand equity to win their buyers' trust. And I want to go and to the very next page, page 118, and ask you to talk about the, I think it was the Seismic acquisition of Lessonly, and you quoted the CMO, Kyle Lacey. She said that one of the keys to the company's growth and success was its decision to cease all measurement of branding efforts. What?
Well, they had branding marketing they were doing. They had a budget for that, and they had a budget for lead and demand gen, and they measured that piece. But the branding piece, they decided, you know, let's just do what strategically makes the most sense, and because these things are best and really can only be measured over the long term, let's allow ourselves the freedom to not be pinned down to metrics that might not allow us to really tell the brand story in the way that's going to have the biggest benefit for the long term. The way I would describe it is, it's like, and the way that I kind of explained to maybe a CEO who came from a sales background or just to a sales leader is, what the experience I've had over many years, frequently in working with sales, is they think that a lot of marketing is, particularly brand marketing, is a waste of time and money. You know, it's not getting me a lead. But I tell them, you know, well, when you are identifying a prospect, do you immediately talk to them about the product, or do you try to convince them that you're worth talking to first?
Wait, whoa, you just blew my mind.
But what I found is, you know, if I wanted to quantify it, look at all the time that salespeople spend earning trust before mm-hmm. they sell anything. Well, yeah, I've been working this relationship for a year. Why haven't you sold anything yet? Well, you know, I took him out to these dinners and I did these things, blah, 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 blah. But it's all leading. It's all leading to that sale. But this is a big purchase for him. He's got to think it's the right thing. Oh, I see. But when it comes to marketing, you just want to put sales collateral online. You know, what marketing has to be online, especially today when so much research is done without involving any salespeople, is scaling the ideal sales experience. And the ideal sales experience doesn't start with sales at all. It starts with building trust. And every good salesperson knows that. That's why I think that talking about trust as opposed to talking about, oh, we got to buy a commercial or build a brand or blah, blah, blah. Just talking about trust. Every salesperson knows they ain't selling anything unless someone trusts us first. Mm-hmm. And would you rather, as a salesperson, have to do all the heavy lifting of building that trust for your brand yourself? Or would you rather your brand set the table for you by working to build that trust? And then, hey, it doesn't matter. The leads will come, all right? The leads, I treat it, working in a lot in logistics and stuff with some of our clients in that space, you know, or in telecom, you know, they talk about that last mile. Mm-hmm. The last mile is very important, but it's the last mile. And so lead generation is the last mile. You know, all the other work that needs to happen gets you to that point where then you can focus on that last mile. But if you're focusing all your budget and efforts on lead generation, it's basically focusing on the 5% of the people in your market who are currently looking to buy. The other 95% not only won't respond to that kind of sales message, they might just be turned off by it. Whereas if you were giving brand building kind of content out there, like thought leadership or showing interesting things or helpful things you're doing in your community, if you're doing that, well, then you'll make an impression with them. So when they are ready to buy, your name is more likely to be top of mind. That's something that when you can connect it to how a good salesperson does their job, they get it. You know, the best salespeople, how many times have you seen a salesperson get hired because, dang, you know, we're hiring them because they worked here and here and here, and they've got 100 relevant contacts that they know. Well, okay, how'd that happen? That happened because they built relationships of trust with them over time. Otherwise, that email list they have or those relationships they have are worthless. And so what you're saying is when you say, oh, I just want to invest in lead gen, I just want to hire salespeople who have these relationships, what you're saying is, rather than build my own brand that the salespeople can leverage, I'm going to just buy the salespeople's brands, their personal brands, and hope they can drag a sale across the finish line. Well, that's a very short-sighted. And it only lasts as long as the salesperson is working for you. And when they're gone, that client's going to buy from them in the next place they go. Why don't you build a brand, then train your salespeople to support that?
Well said. And I want to jump to chapter 11, earning approval. Page 162, you write, people want to hear what other people say about you, not what you say about yourself. And then in the chapter, you outline some strategies. One of them is media relations, which I think people are more familiar with. You make that case very clearly that the PR folks understand that. But the other two are influencer marketing and online reviews. Talk about those two. What kind of pushback do you get when you go to clients and say, you know, we're looking at, if you even say these terms, but influencer marketing and online reviews?
Well, we used to have, you know, many years ago, Yelp emerged on the consumer side and restaurants and all these things, and people knew the power of reviews in that space. But only in the last, say, 3 or 4 years has it become something that's everywhere. So in B2B tech, I know at least 2 or 3 years ago, I was constantly having to convince clients that the review sites mattered, that G2 mattered, that, you know, these sites mattered. And over time, it's become obvious, but with all these things, to the extent you're on the front end, you can take advantage of those things sooner. I know that we got a lot of business from a couple years ago on by being very focused on our review site presence and optimizing that. You know, there are a surprising percentage of business owners who say they don't even look at online reviews, let alone respond to negative ones or try to encourage positive ones. That's something that is just short-sighted. You need to be focusing on that, because there's a lot of people that if they're closer to looking to buy or looking to come work for you or whatever, they're looking at these reviews. And so, as a PR agency, it's a natural extension of what PR firms have done. It's just the source of third-party validation, rather than being the media, is the customer themselves. In the case of influencer marketing, or on the PR side, traditionally they've called it influencer relations. I created a model that's in the book called the Continuum of Influence, in which I say that we, in our different silos within PR and marketing, tend to look at things in a siloed way. And if you look at all the sources of information and influence based on the impact they can have versus, oh, the Kardashians are paid influencers and the New York Times is a trusted media source. Well, in my model, they're equivalent. You know, all that matters is that it, for some audiences, the Kardashians are going to be, and their endorsement on social media of your product are going to be more influential. And to other audiences, a New York Times profile is going to be more influential. And so if you look at the continuum of influence, it starts with that individual customer review. You know, that for it's not anybody who's anybody's heard of. It might even be anonymous review. It could be. But if it connects with an individual buyer in terms of it being the same use case or other things that connect, that individual customer review is going to be more important than a big social media influencer's endorsement or a big media article or what have you. So it's all about figuring out which sources of influence are important. And they all, whether it's influencers, and influencers go from the individual customer to, say, brand ambassadors. In the social media world, they talk about, nano, micro, macro, mega influencers. Understanding which ones are important to you and can help you, it doesn't matter whether they're paid or unpaid.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
A lot of PR firms say, oh, we only do unpaid, we only do earned, so we only will work with an influencer who doesn't request payment. Well, that's a very old-fashioned approach to this, because guess what? You know, influencers have to make a living too.
Yeah.
And what they do to make a living is they balance the fact that they get paid with the fact that their audiences will abandon them if they think they're making recommendations just based on the fact that they got paid.
Mm-hmm.
So the point I make is that in PR versus advertising, the distinction always used to be paid versus earned.
Church and state, right?
Yeah. And it's so artificial and counterproductive today to think that way. Today, it's all about trusted or untrusted. So if the Kardashians promoting a product, if the people that are their audience believe that they use this product, they're shown using it, they believe it, then that's all that matters. It's different from influencers It's different from the kind of old-fashioned celebrity advertising where you could just have any random celebrity promoting any random product, and you're just hoping the value of their celebrity would help you sell the product. Today, for influencers of any size, in most cases, obviously, you know, the Kardashians, for example, are a celebrity, traditional celebrity too. But if you look at most influencers, and the most influencers have the biggest impact are smaller, and they have devoted followings, and they follow the influencer not because they're a celebrity. The influencer became an influencer because they know and care about and have interesting things to say specifically about the space itself, about the industry itself, about the product itself. They're knowledgeable. So it's actually way more effective way of using a known person's endorsement of your product because it's more credible and more trusted by their audience. And the audience is often more targeted to the kind of folks that might be your buying audience. So that it's just kind of taking a more modern view of how
nuanced,
it works. Of how it works today and not being held back by traditional models.
Yes, and I should add that thanks to you, I learned about the HBO documentary Fake Followers, which I watched this week. So you mentioned that, and of course, I immediately sent that to my kids.
Well, it's called Fake Famous, I think.
Oh, Fake Famous. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but they talk a lot about fake followers in there.
Oh, that's right. It's Fake Famous. Yeah. Sorry. Well, it had a big impact. I just forgot the correct name.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, really well done. Real eye-opener. Well, let's talk about reputation management. Let's talk about sucking, okay? On page 196, if you quote a reputation management consultant friend of yours who said, if you suck in real life, you'll suck on the internet. you write that reputation management is arguably the most critical component. So can you explain what reputation management is or what you mean by it and why it's becoming more difficult and what companies should be at least thinking about?
Well, yeah, the simplest way to describe it is it's PR playing defense where you're thinking about, sometimes it can be some of the same activities that you do when you're say your PR outreach to get positive reviews or to get positive media coverage. You want to in a reputation management program, you want to lay that same kind of groundwork that you would be as you're thinking and just thinking about growth through PR. But the difference is you're looking at it through the lens of being insulation to protect you. So in other words, if something negative happens, the first thing, let's say there's a controversy on social media surrounding your brand, or someone's complaining very vocally about you, or someone writes a negative story about you. Well, the other people that are going to cover this or write about it or post about it, the first thing they're going to do if they don't already know your brand is they're going to Google you. So if they Google and they don't find anything but this negative thing that's already out there, that's going to be their impression. But if they find out all this context that's positive, they're going to give you the benefit of the doubt in most cases. So the example I use, true life example, is there was a woman who at my first newspaper job, she had
and I should
hired.
Interrupt here, Scott, yeah. And say this story is the one that spoke to me the most.
From your personal experience?
Yeah.
It's a young woman. She had just been hired to work at the newspaper I was at. Her first day was going to be the following Monday, but there was a party that some folks on the staff were having the weekend before, so like that Friday night before. And so she came to it, and she's introduced. She was probably a little nervous, so she doubled up on the liquid courage. She got very intoxicated, and there was a signature moment that everyone would remember, which made it worse, which was she mistook the bathroom for the laundry room, and mistook specifically the dryer for the toilet.
And she tried to relieve herself in the dryer. But Scott, that's happened to all of us.
Is that right? Well, in any case, it's one of those things, unfortunately, beyond getting drunk, it's the kind of story that I remember all these years later.
Yes.
And so you can imagine that everybody was telling it. And guess what? She didn't even show up to work on Monday. You know, she did not. Yeah. She did not come in. She see her as a person. And by the way, not the easiest thing in the world, especially then, to get a newspaper job. And she got it. She had been hired, but she was so mortified.
Yeah.
And she figured her reputation had been ruined before she even started, so she didn't come in. Now, I said, contrast that.
Yeah, let's imagine the scenario differently.
If it was someone who had been working at the paper for 10 years, and she or he had done exactly the same thing, but they would come in on Monday, and they might get a little good-natured ribbing. Maybe if they were really intoxicated in a concerning way, their editor might want to, or their boss might want to have a just chat with them, make sure everything was okay at home, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But you'd get past it and you'd move on because you had 10 years of yes. building a positive reputation. And so that's the biggest and most important part of reputation management is building that positive reputation that will insulate you and give and make it more likely people will give you the benefit of the doubt when something bad happens. Because guess what? We all make mistakes. Misunderstandings happen. Things will happen. A lot of times what are called cancellations today are really unfair. You know, sometimes, you know, things, people get what they deserve. Sometimes it's more about the person who's leading these kind of campaigns, you know, scoring points on social media, because social media rewards people that can identify someone to attack. That's just the reality of just how the algorithms work. So sometimes you can be a fairly innocent bystander out there and become the subject of something. We had I go to the local hair salon that during COVID, they suddenly their voicemail was just full of these hateful voicemails, and they had all these negative reviews that suddenly appeared in social media, and they didn't know what was going on. Well, apparently, also in Dallas, where I am, another salon that had a similar name had done something controversial. And this salon, complete innocent bystanders, they got caught up in it. They probably, it caused tremendous damage to their business before they could get it all corrected. And so anybody can kind of fall victim to this, and you have to be ready for it. And having a strong presence online, establishing a positive reputation, is the first step. Now, all the other things that you might think of in terms of crisis communication or reputation management, like responding quickly when someone complains, and doing listening, so you're tapping into when anyone says anything, so you can respond to it before it kind of takes off and creates a life of its own. All those things are important from a responsive standpoint. But what I like to emphasize with clients is let's start by just building a presence that's going to provide you some protection by letting people know more about what you're really all about, as opposed to this one bad thing that might happen at some point.
Yes. And I should add that there's a page where you talk about responding to reviews. Very important. And my brothers and I have a beach house in Florida, and it's managed by a management company. But they are, at our encouragement, they're very good at responding to every single review and doing it promptly. So I scanned it. I scanned those pages and sent it to them and said, you know, keep up the good work. Don't take my word for it, the customer. You know, look at what Scott Baradell has written. So thank you for that. Just a couple more things I want to ask about before we wrap up that I just found very interesting. One of it is it relates to, you talk about full funnel content. And you write that many books and articles on inbound marketing focus almost exclusively on the content that brands create themselves, as if this, you know, content lived in a vacuum. Can you talk about the idea and the appeal of using content that's not necessarily your own media, but how that can actually help with your trust?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, this is my perspective on it. You know, let's look at, you know, your traditional funnel. You can imagine, you know, awareness, decision, action, whatever. But mm-hmm. and you're saying, okay, I've got three stages, and I want to have an equal amount of content at each stage so I can nurture someone wherever they are, from top of the funnel down to decision. That's the way many inbound marketing firms, that way many company marketing departments think about it.
Well, and you can control it. I could understand the appeal. You know, you can control that. But when you're not using someone else's content, it's almost like getting links to your website or getting, you know, managing your reviews. Those are things you can't necessarily control, but you need to address.
Right. And I would just say that as opposed to thinking in terms of the content you're creating, as opposed to a third, well, start with the idea that 95% of the people you're trying to reach only care about that top part. All right. And then so let's focus on, let's get very tactical and about doing that part that's going to the bottom part, middle and bottom parts of the funnel for that 5% that you're trying to drive home. But spend the bulk of your efforts on that top part. And today, as opposed to it being, to your point, instead of it being, opposed to being like thought leadership that's on your blog that you hope you can get people to find through search, put thought leadership content in publications like Forbes, Fast Company, Entrepreneur. There are all kinds of cool programs out there to make that easier to do, where you get a lot of visibility in Google News, LinkedIn mentioning of the news. Getting your content in front of audiences where they are, and getting your ideas in front of audiences where they are. It could be a long form LinkedIn post, for example, that doesn't link to your site, because guess what? Google's algorithms, like all of them, they greatly favor a LinkedIn post that's long, that doesn't have an outbound link, because they want people to stay on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And so these are examples of...
Well, that's what LinkedIn wants.
Yes, that's what LinkedIn wants. And you want it too, because you want more people to see it. And so... So it becomes kind of tactical and gamey a little bit, but so it's much better, for example, if your goal was to get people to come to your site, to put the link in the first comment, to leave a comment on your own post linking to your site, as opposed to having it in the main post. That's just one tactical thing. But the bigger picture is, hey, you know why LinkedIn wants the content to be on the site? Frankly, because their users don't want to be going back and forth. It's mm-hmm. like Google. Google, you know, they have very much a strategy to have fewer and fewer people have to click to find the content they want within the Google universe, as opposed to going offsite. So if that's a universe that you live in, take advantage of it and say, you know what? I'm going to post some really good top of the funnel stuff out there and above the funnel stuff out there so people get to know me. And you know what? When they're ready to find me, they'll find me. Mm-hmm. Don't write your old-fashioned, you know, white paper where the last third of it is, and here's the reasons why everything I said today means you should buy from me now. Right. Because you just lost all the credibility you built up. Oh. You just wasted your time. But too many companies still do that. It's like when we do a survey, all right? We do surveys as part of digital PR. We want the surveys to be about topics that relate back to our client and what the client does, but we don't make that connection in the survey report or the press release. We give the customer the benefit of the doubt there, because guess what? Once you make a direct connection and say, and the reason we did this survey is so you'll buy our product, mm-hmm. here is how A connects to B. You know, if you do that, then the media no longer will cover your survey. They'll say buy an ad, and people will just consider it less credible. Let them have the aha moment. You don't have to have it for them.
So just to jump ahead, just a couple of the quick things I think might surprise people or may need a refreshing on is, you write that Google has made it clear that combining PR and SEO is the most effective and least spammy search strategy of all. Explain why earning media coverage is, as you say, the single best way to tell Google your site is important.
Yeah, for two reasons. You know, one is... you know, Google looks at two things in terms of your link building strategy. You know, as we talked about with citations, and you know, it's other sites linking to you, that third party validation that tells Google how important and relevant your site is in any mm-hmm. given search. So, in terms of the links that you get, if you can get let's say you're in the retail space, and you get a top retail trade publication to write about a survey you did or a product you released or anything, and then link back to your survey page or your product page or your homepage, that's huge. And that's way more valuable from an SEO standpoint because it's both authoritative, top trade publication, and relevant, a retail trade publication. That's way more valuable than doing some of the often questionable things that are done for SEO to get links from, you know, little sites that don't really matter much. You know, as Google has said, top authority site linking back to you can be worth a million bad links linking back to you.
Yeah, I remember years ago, I was at a conference and I saw Arianna Huffington deliver a keynote and it was really funny. And I wrote a blog post about it just because I thought my blog readers might enjoy it. And later, I saw that the Huffington Post had linked to it. And I came up on the analytics and cool. I was like, whoa, wow, thanks, Arianna.
Exactly.
Yeah. So just one other thing I want to tell you. You mentioned thought leadership earlier, and this is something that's of great interest to listeners. On page 246, you write, most B2B marketing executives today list positioning their company as a thought leader as one of their top objectives. And then you go on to write, the worst kept secret in marketing is that most thought leadership content is crap. Scott Baradell, why do you argue that bad thought leadership is actually worse than none at all?
Well, because, you know, as you know, let's go back to the individual sales experience. You know, if you have a great conversation with a salesperson, it's helpful to making a sale. If you have a really bad conversation, it's worse than never having that conversation at all because the person's never going to want to interact with you again. So if someone gives – you're making a bargain – when you're putting thought leadership content out there, you're telling them to trust you that the content that you put out there is worth their time. And if they had to pay for it, worth their money, but generally, you know, worth their time. And then if you give them crap, a bunch of regurgitated sales collateral or you know, just a bunch of hodgepodge of stuff that's just not very good because you thought you had to put some thought leadership piece together. Oh, you had some of the PR firm said, hey, you want to buy a line in this trade publication? Sure, let me slap some stuff together. If you do that, that's definitely worse than not doing it at all. It's not all publicity is not good publicity in that sense. So if you're going to do it right, which means have a point of view, put some thought into it, care about it. I like to, you know, in what are called guest posts in SEO or called bylined articles in the PR world. And I like that term because it goes back to in byline because it's got your CEO's byline on it or your SME's byline on at the top of the article. I reference that, you know, the byline is actually the term was created by Ernest Hemingway. He coined the term. And it was a book he wrote where they were talking about newspaper journalism. And the byline has come over time. It was originally to just get you in trouble if there was facts wrong in your story. But it came to mean something really important. You know, the top columnists in the country, the Roy Coes of the world, they were all established based on their byline. To a reporter and having someone who came as someone who came from journalism, I can tell you, your bylines are precious. You know, getting your byline on the front page of the paper, you worked your butt off on that story and your name is on that and it made the front page and that's meaningful to you. So what I try to do when we're creating thought leadership content is to tell the CEO or whoever is producing this, and of course we will ghostwrite it for them. It doesn't matter who actually writes it, but the ideas have to come from the heart and come from the brain of the company. You know, care about it. Mm-hmm. If you care about it, everything else will take care of itself. But the reason there's so much crap out there is that there's considered to be like some obligation to put this kind of content out there. And it's counterproductive if you don't care about it and don't make the effort to make it good.
Yeah, well said. And it's almost like that notion of check the box marketing. Okay, good.
Right.
Leadership. Or I think it's another part, you were talking about podcasts, and it's like, Don't start a podcast if you're not going to keep it going. And that reminded me of the statistic from Libsyn about most podcasts never make it to episode 8. But somebody thought it was a good idea to start one and check the box. Last question I want to ask related to that is when you're writing thought leadership, you talk about how it should begin at the second sentence. Can you explain that concept?
Yeah, it's someone who had been on the editorial board at a publication who'd worked with Idea Grove had said, you know, when the editorial writers were having their meetings about what editorials they would write for the paper, and someone said, hey, well, we just had this big, let's say we had this big school shooting and it's terrible and blah, blah, blah. Well, and something needs to be done about it. Well, what's your second sentence? What do you have to say about this that 1,000 other people aren't saying right now? And that's when that's the hard part. Yes, we know this is a topic that is of interest, but what do you have to say that's not what everybody else has to say?
Yeah, make a stand.
Yeah. You know, the one thing, when people say, it's easy to think, hey, we're in a world of billions of people, right? And there's so much content online, so many blog posts, so much everything. It's easy to feel like, oh, what? How is mine going to be any different? And we got AI now, right? That's, you know, that will write your articles for you. That's obviously gotten a lot of coverage and attention lately. What it can't do is be you. And so to the extent you're infusing your own personal experiences in your writing, no one else can do that because no one else has lived the same experiences as you. So write from the heart, write from your experiences. And if you do it in a consistent way, we strongly promote with our clients that just like you have a unique value proposition for your product, have a unique thought leadership narrative theme for all your thought leadership. And then not that you're writing about the same thing over and over again, but you're writing thematically about the same priorities, that those things will come back to you. It will be remembered. And it's because it's from the heart and it's because you made it unique to yourself through your own personal experiences. And that's something that requires a level of vulnerability to get to that second sentence that a lot of executives either say they don't have time for it or they don't feel comfortable doing it. But if you're not going to, then, you know, your content is going to be generic content that's not really distinguishable from others.
Yes, and it's interesting where you talk about how, you know, a lot of in-house marketers try to find ways to produce thought leadership content without taking up the executive's time, and why that's almost always a mistake. And, you know, why that, another reason why so many executive visibility programs never get off the ground. But let me just conclude with this one line from page 251, where you write, creating a thought leadership platform begins at the second sentence. It begins when you break away from the chorus of voices in your industry, all saying the same things. It begins when you move past the obvious and start offering value and perspective that align with your brand story and purpose. So, Scott, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Don't get overwhelmed by all the choices online. That you can prioritize by focusing on what matters to your audience.
Well said. And it's not just media hits, as we used to say.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Well, let's give the listener something to do today, just to put in action one of the ideas from your book.
Something to go do today?
Yeah. Get the snowball rolling down the hill. One thing to put in action, an idea from the book, perhaps while they're waiting for the book to arrive.
Well, this is what I would do. We talk about in the book in terms of getting started, that I'm sure, you know, you've seen your online experience, you know what your customers and buyers have, how they found you, hopefully, and things like that. Look at the whole landscape and create what I call a wish list, which means that you're thinking about all the things that you could do to grow, whatever your goal is, to grow, whatever it might be. And so that might be, hey, I want to get coverage in these publications and the trades. I want to get more reviews on this site. I want to get testimonials. I want to get a Better Business Bureau certification. Whatever you want, put those all on a list and then go through the effort and have the discipline to think about how to order those in terms of priority, priority being where you get the most bang for your buck. So what this often, we do this with our clients, and what often happens is, yes, they had this goal of getting in some big publication, and we say, yes, but that could take a whole lot of time. This is what be the likely ROI on that or result on that. what if you did these things? Maybe these things are a little less glamorous, like go soliciting some six more customer reviews, mm-hmm. or setting up a presence on this review site that you hadn't thought about yet, but that's getting relevant traffic. Those kinds of things, like that kind of prioritization through this kind of what I call this wish list technique, that's a great way to start trying to get your head around the opportunities so you can take the next step of figuring out which opportunities are worth pursuing first.
Oh, great advice. The secret to getting ahead is getting started. And that just brings to mind a visual of a whole bunch of post-it notes on a whiteboard, and you can just move them around and say, all right, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's work on these things. And boss, we know you want to be in Forbes. We've got that on the whiteboard here, but it's just not going to happen tomorrow. Okay. So Looking back, what books have most inspired your work and career, Scott?
Well, I'll tell you that the book that probably had the most impact on me was one I read in college. It's a very long book by someone named Richard Kluger named Simple Justice. It's many hundreds of pages long. It's been a while since I've read it, but it's long. And what it is it's a history of the African-American experience in the United States through the lens of the legal system. So you imagine starting with the Constitution and the earliest founding fathers documents and how they treated issues like slavery, African-American experience, to the Dred Scott decision of the Supreme Court that said, slaves weren't people essentially, or the white man did not need to abide by, laws for white men when it involved black people, things like that, up to Brown versus Board of Education and the desegregation of schools. So what's amazing about this book, truly amazing, is how he was able to create this full view, a comprehensive perspective on the African experience. But obviously that's a vast subject, right? So he was able to do it through this lens, very specific lens, of through the legal system and how you could track legal case to legal case. I was taking in a history of U.S. law class is what I read this in. And from legal case to legal case, and how you could construct this amazing comprehensive story. And so it actually, in some ways, if you read Trust Signals, you'll see that I was a history major, love history. There's a lot of history in the book. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of having a perspective on a big, a focused perspective on a bigger topic that helps bring clarity to the bigger topic. Because, and that's really what Trust Signals tries to do, is I try to take a very specific concept of Trust Signals and apply that to this much broader and can be very overwhelming and confusing world of marketing today. Marketing and PR today online. And the idea is if you could just look at that through this prism, it can give you some clarity or give you an easier access point to think about some of these challenges and some of these solutions. And so I very much, from the time I read that book, have always been inspired by, authors that were able to do that. Take something complex and finding some angle to look through it where you could where it didn't kind of consume you with how big the topic was.
Interesting. Yes, I see. It's Simple Justice, The History of Brown versus Board of Education and Black America's Struggle for Equality. Richard Kluger, it's almost 900 pages, written in 2011. Amazing.
He wrote a book after that. I think it was called Ashes to Ashes. That's about the history of the tobacco in the United States from, that's fascinating also, but Civil Justice would be the one to read if you're interested.
Yeah. Ashes to Ashes, America's 100-year cigarette war, the public health and the unabashed triumph of Philip Morris. Boy, he just tackles all the big ones.
He does. He does.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Well, hey, I appreciate you sharing that. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Well, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to reading. Like, I think a week, it was supposed to come out the same day in October, the new book by Anne Handley, the new version of Everybody Writes, the updated second version of Everybody Writes 2, I guess. Mm-hmm. I've been looking forward to that. I've known her for many years. She's an amazing writer. She was in the content marketing game before it was content marketing. Incredibly knowledgeable. Of course, she's become a huge keynote speaker and stuff too, because she's got a great personality and presence. But she's just at base an outstanding writer, and Everybody Writes is about that. It's about writing, and she's I read the first one. Looking forward to this one.
Hear, hear. And that was on episode 411 of the Marketing Book Podcast in November. I'll include a link to that on this episode's website page. And yes, everybody should subscribe to her newsletter. Go to annhandley.com and sign up for it. Every other Sunday, you get this phenomenal newsletter. It's great. I love it. And I love her. So it's funny, you know, we're both big Anne Handley fans, and we're both big Adele Rovella fans. So
yes.
Who knew? Who knew? Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, and your company site, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. Now, a word to you, my dear listener. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to Scott and congratulate him on this book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast and putting up with a lot of stupid jokes. Send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter, or go to his website. Check out his blog. Sign up for that. Guests on the show have told me that they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone, you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. All these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quotes from page 282 and 283. From page 282, PR is the art of securing trust at scale. And page 283, people demand places to put their trust. Supply them that place, and you've got a customer, employee, or fan of your brand for life. The book is Trust Signals, Brand Building in a Post-Truth World. The author is Scott Baradell. Scott, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Thanks so much for taking the time and care to really read through the book. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you are one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.